All right, folks, so we're back again with the podcast. This is a little different intro because I failed to get one earlier, and that's because we jumped right in with our guest. This week we had Mark Hayes, who is the lead engineer over at Matthews. He was kind enough to sit down with us for just over an hour and just talk new bows. So as you guys know, Matthews launched new bows for 2025 this year. We got the Lift X. I got one here laying on the table. They actually ended up launching four new bows. So you have the Lift X in two different axle-to-axle lengths, and you also have a new long draw version of that bow, and then just a shorter version for short draw archers, and then even some lower poundages for, you know, kids or women that want to shoot a new Matthews bow. So super cool opportunity to sit down and talk to Mark. So I hope you guys enjoy the podcast. Me and Brady and Lorenzo got a chance to visit with Mark and kind of pick his brain on what his job is like over at Matthews, and then also just really run through the new technology and the new bows. I also wanted to hit you guys with a promo because I failed to miss that. So you guys can use the promo code PODCAST when you sign up for a Go Hunt Insider membership. And actually, we have a special deal running through December 5th. If you use that promo code, you're going to get 100 points back in the Go Hunt gear shop. So 1 point is $1, so that's 100 bucks back in your account that you can use towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. So maybe you want to kit out a brand new Matthews Lift X bow with a new sight, new arrows, new release. So pretty cool opportunity to put 100 bucks in your pocket and also get a brand new Go Hunt Insider research account, which is packed with information that you guys are going to need to apply and draw permits, find hunts in 2025. So check that out. Also, just check out the Black Friday sale in general. We have a ton of gear on sale right now. I was just out in the lobby filming some promos for some daily deals that are upcoming. Also, Sitka. Sitka's got some select items that are on sale, including the Ambient 75 hoodie, which I think everybody should have one of those. That thing's 25% off coming up. So check that out. I hope you guys enjoy the podcast with Mark. He's a good dude. Makes a phenomenal bow over there at Matthews. So enjoy the podcast. Or launch day is always pretty hectic, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, for us, usually not. This year has been difficult.
Why?
Normally for us, like as an engineering team, we're done. We're in production. Everything's running smoothly. So, you know, marketing's staying up at midnight and sales is ripping. But, you know, we are organizing, getting ready for next year. So normally it's easy for us. This year's been, it's been a race to get to the finish line. It's been not easy.
Gotcha.
We've got a lot of challenges here at the end, but we finally made it.
Can you see all of us? So you got Brady and Lorenzo at the end. I don't know if you can see Lorenzo or not.
I can see Brady. Lorenzo's
on the corner. You can lean
down. Good.
Sorry, we were trying to double up. So Brady's leaving on an elk hunt tomorrow. He's got his brother Drew a tag. And so we're trying to do one earlier to get one out this week and then one for next week as well. So it's just been a hectic day at the office, which I'm sure sounds like you have as well.
Yeah. No problem. It's worked out.
So we got the new bow on the table, which this will launch. We'll get a chance to talk to it. But I wanted to talk to you basically because I think what's your official title over there?
They call me the design engineering manager, but we got a lot of engineers, so I usually say one of the engineers.
How many engineers do you guys have over there?
About eight, including Matt, who's the lead engineer, and then seven on my team.
Gotcha. How much time does Matt still put in? Like, is he still there every day, day in and day out, grinding it out with you guys?
He's always thinking about it every day. There'll be times where he's in every single day, and there'll be times I won't see him for weeks, but that's not, doesn't mean he doesn't have work for us. We call him, text him. When he's on the road, it's like, we're busy because he's thinking and calling and texting. So
that's kind
I can
of
always tell when he's traveling.
That's kind of like you and Porter.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's how Porter, our CEO, same Lorenzo. It seems like every time you guys get back from a trip, you guys got some windshield time. Yeah, you have a laundry list.
When you're stuck, in the office all day, it's just that echo chamber. So it's the same conversations over and over and over. You don't ever have that like fresh thought or like a new experience that makes you think of a new way to think about something.
Yeah.
So when you're out, that's when all that happens.
We don't have downtime just as like a culture and like that. The drive is the last piece of downtime you have, and that's when you can really dive deep into something
where you can think differently. You're not just stuck in the same way.
When do you do your best thinking, Mark? You a morning run kind of guy or a shower guy? When's it hit?
Usually if I'm stuck, I gotta leave. I've learned that. So if I'm sitting at a computer or sitting at a desk or something, if I have to go to the bathroom, if I have to go get a part out of inventory, it's like that walk down the stairs and back up is when I usually figure it out.
Gotcha.
Quick thinker.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
That was way too quick for me.
Yeah, I need like 5 days.
Five business days for me to come up with something.
I'll be like, sorry, I'm headed to the woods for the next 5 days. See if we can sort this out.
That is the best thinking.
There's too much to think about in the woods. I don't know how people think in the woods. I'm thinking about like my next move. I can't think about work stuff.
Yeah, that's the best part about hunting is you just disconnect from all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you from Wisconsin? Where are you from originally?
No, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I grew up there.
Are you a Steelers fan?
Oh, yeah.
Bro, what is going on?
We're rolling,
Teams
man.
For real this year.
Steelers Nation, baby.
I'm crazy.
Hell yeah.
I have a bunch of kids, and we haven't watched football in years. I have been totally disconnected, but this year we've been watching everything, and it's awesome.
Yeah,
they might be the single best franchise ever because they win when they're shitty and they really win when they're good.
Hmm.
It's such a good franchise.
The fans are the best. I mean, they'll let anyone know that they're not doing a good job. When we put Russell in that first week, the Steelers fans were not pumped about it.
So. Yeah.
That's what I just saw last night. Some meme about how do you know Russell's back? And he like makes this incredible play in the pocket to
and then throws an interception. Yeah. That's how you know.
I loved it. I expected some fantastic pass, and he throws it right in the end zone to a straight interception.
Yep, that's
pretty
Russ.
Pretty hilarious.
Danger Russ, man.
Yeah. How long you worked at Matthews?
13 years. I started as an intern in 2011.
As an intern?
Yep.
Is that typically like how you guys pipeline in there at Matthews? You start as an intern or like a college program, or how does that work?
No, I got super lucky. I've been writing letters to this place since I was 16 and just bombarded them. And I happened to just hit it right where they needed some summer help. And because I've been bombarding them and annoying them for years, they called me first and I got lucky.
That's a pretty cool story.
I don't know if that's luck. That's persistence, keeping yourself at the top of their minds.
Dude, Mark, I had no idea. That's an awesome story.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was pretty singular-minded.
I have a 101 question for you. Like, what being an archery or bow engineer, is that a different type of engineering than, like, most everything else? Or do you still go to the same types of schools and all that stuff?
Yeah, so I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm pretty biased, but I think that's the most well-rounded, you know, not an expert in electronics, not an expert in computer programming, but can do all those things. And then mechanical systems, how things move, why things move, forces, all that stuff is all mechanical. So like if you think about a civil engineer, they're building buildings and roads, things that can't move. Mechanical engineers are always making things that do move. So it's pretty broad. But, you know, the cool thing about physics and engineering in general is the laws are the same. How you apply them is different. And I think, you know, the key to education is like getting a base of math and all, you know, all the stuff that you need, but not necessarily like on the job training. I get to, you know, work for the best O engineer that there ever was, and he never went to college. And so, you know, an important part of my job and anybody that works here is apply the things, the foundations that are important, but put them aside because I'm working for a guy that never went to school, actually despises school, never did good in school. So he teaches you how to think outside of the box. I think one of the key things that he teaches us is shoot for the impossible and then back up. And it's easy to say, but, you know, traditionally in an engineering field or in a normal company that doesn't have rapid product cycles, you're improving like this step at a time. And then like when you truly want to innovate, you would say, okay, what is the best it could possibly be, but impossible, and then back into what's impossible or which is actually possible. And that's how he sets the thing up. It's like, all right, a stabilizer, for example, the best one that could ever be would be infinitely light and infinitely stiff. Well, we can't do that, but we know that that would be perfect. And so, like, how close can we get to that? And that's what kind of Matt brings to the table. He's also not afraid of trying stuff. So, you know, a lot of engineers will spend a ton of time doing the math, doing FEA computer analysis, all the cool nerdy stuff. that's not where we start. You know, where we start is let's build it, let's break it, and once we love it, then we'll validate it with math and computer stuff. But we're going to go break it. We're going to go make it. And that's, you know, I think the lie a lot of companies tell themselves is let's not spend a ton of time making prototypes. Let's just get a design as far as we can without prototypes so we don't have to waste that money. Matt flips that around. We waste the money. We make the prototype because we learn so fast that way that we can go backwards and get the numbers. We can know that a bow is less vibration and quieter. I don't need to know it's 13% quieter until marketing asks, you know. I just need to know that it is better. And I think that's the secret. That's how we go so fast.
Makes a lot of sense. I actually love that answer too. I mean, a lot of like when you're in worlds like engineering and all that stuff, like you can get stuck in a box and do everything by the book. But what makes the best engineers is when they kind of just go free flying, figure it out, and then go back to the box and be like, okay, why does this work? Or how does this work? And then figure it out.
Yeah, and you get a good gut too. Like you can make decisions on the fly that way because you've seen so many things. And that's so important too in manufacturing in general.
Why archery for you, Mark? Like, why were you writing Matthews at 16?
So I grew up in Pennsylvania, and that's like Wisconsin that everybody hunts. So, of course, I was a hunter. And I remember my dad, you know, the first good job he got, the first thing he did was buy Matthews. And I remember that. I was a kid. He bought an MQ-1. It was a huge deal. I remember looking at it. And then I worked a summer when I was like 12 or 13. I worked really hard, cut wood and all stuff. And the deal was he'd pay me or we could go get a bow. And so that year we both bought matching switchbacks. And gotcha. That's when like the Matthews craze was crazy. Mm-hmm. My dad was always a bow hunter. He's self-taught. And so that's what I learned. And one of the things I loved was he taught kind of instinctive shooting. And I still do that. And he did it with a compound. And so the reason why I shoot like a 5-pin still, because he would always call it floating. So he'd have always like a 20 and a 30. He'd always shoot a 2-pin, but he'd float it, you know, 45-yard shot. He just knew the arc of his arrow. And like, I just learned that way. And I just love that arc of the arrow. I can still shoot without sights. And not that I would hunt that way, but it's just like, that's the magic of like archery is just, you know, knowing in an instant without aiming, just like knowing your shot. And so I fell in love with archery as a lot of kids do. And I took a physics class when I was about the time I started writing Matthews 11. I was just overzealous, but I was very good at physics. I knew I liked science, but never found my niche. And I was the one in the front of the class. I was the nerd. I just loved it. It stuck me in sense.
We had very different childhoods.
You were looking at numbers?
No.
I can get down with the archery thing, but I stop at physics and math and chemistry and that kind of thing.
Yep, 100%.
That's wild. So you've been there for quite a while, Matthews. You've seen quite a few iterations of bows go out the door, right?
Yeah, I hit probably my favorite phase because I got to watch Matthews go from, you know, a successful company, but still small, going through growing pains. And I got to grow with them. And the last season has been probably the funnest to watch. You know, the grit and the grind, we always laugh. We have a big, beautiful engineering department now. And when I started, it was plywood floors and chain link fence. And like, we joke about it, but that was the grit that I'm talking about. That's the like making it happen thing, the growing the company to what it is now. And so I'm super blessed. I'm so excited that I've gotten to watch that in those 13 years of, you know, I saw Matthews as the top of the hill, just amazing. And the leap that we are from there, what I saw before I started, is huge. It's been fun to be a part of.
I was curious, everybody puts out a new bow. How do you feel about a new bow every year? Like, what does that pressure feel like? Because it feels kind of bizarre and strange to me. I mean, you look at a lot of different companies. I mean, it's just weird that it must feel extremely like a lot of pressure every single year. Like, oh, you got to have a new bow. It's got to have advancements. Got to do different things.
And it's always got to be better.
Yeah. Yes and no. You know, it sounds cliche, but, you know, I was talking about it before. Matt has baked in to question everything. And we are constantly questioning, you know, the reason I was late to this is I was working on, you know, new stuff that might never see the light of day, but we're always pushing, you know, past, because, you know, I talk about how a lot of companies, they iterate. Well, like, what's cool about that, we don't, you know, we start here and work backwards, but what's cool is that the confidence is, well, now that we can do this, we can do that. And it's like, if that learning is baked into this place, and it's naturally, we don't stop. We just keep like, wow, I didn't know we could ever do this. Now that we can do that, can we do that? And like, so that level never changes, whether that's performance or if that's features or accessories. You know, we've really fallen in love with just the whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Now that we have this, what else can we do? And it's pressure. For sure, it's high demand. You know, I tell people all the time, like, I'm not sure you actually want what you think you want. It's not always easy, but it's a pretty simple calculation. So it's just,
yeah,
we are wired to continue to question. And I do understand that, like, the product cycle we are on is vicious. I mean, if you are inside our interior conversations, the main stress is that new product cycle is just so outrageous. But what you learn is that without that, we would not push as hard as we push. Mm. And that's honestly where the fun is. You know, we could have a lift bow that is just the pinnacle of archery, the best we could ever had. We could have that for 4 to 5 years. I truly believe that. But we wouldn't, the next iteration wouldn't be fractions as good, even if we had 4 to 5 years to work on it, because we wouldn't be driving. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the difference. And that's why I like it so much, as hard as it is. The trick is, how do you do that healthy?
Yeah.
We're working on that.
Yeah. Seems like an enormous amount of stress to me anyway. You look at just the pace that those come up.
I have gray hair.
Yeah, you've got more than when I first met you, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Is there anybody you got any Franken bows like kicking around that you've just like put together for your own kicks and giggles to see?
If I can turn that camera around.
Yeah. Oh, dang. How far out in advance are you? Like, what are you working on? 2026, 2027?
Yeah, we're not as.
Love technology.
That pressure to come up with something new is important for us. Mm-hmm. So we are working on next year, but there'll be things we learn this year that don't ever make it. And 3 to 5 years from now, we can be like, remember when we did that? That might fit on this thing. And so, like, in that sense, we're working way ahead. We're always patenting new ideas and just saving them for the right time, or just saving them because we think it's something that could use, whether we use it or not. Matt puts a lot of emphasis on IP, but truly we're working 1 year at a time. And that's key, because, you know, if you get a bow done and you put it on that wall, if it sits there too long, it's no longer cool. And so as frustrating as it is to be pushing the limit and pushing the timeline every year, that's where the innovation happens. You know, I think about the lift. I had a bow done in December that year, like done. It was awesome, better than last year's. But in January, Matt comes flying in with a brand new limb arrangement idea. And that's where that started the lift. And so we restarted our whole design process, and it was grueling, but it made the lift, you know,
yeah.
So well worth it.
Yeah. I feel bad for you. I feel like you don't ever get that like new bowl filling, like pulling it out of the box, you know. And I've never, like, for me, I look forward to it every year. So like if I get my bow and it's, you know, that proto or whatever, and I get it like in August or September, first part of September, and inevitably I'm always on a hunt when I get it, and it shows up at my house, and I text my wife, and she knows as soon as I get a bow shows up at the house, you know, she's supposed to give me a call or text me. So she'll send me a text message. She'll be like, I have a bow box on the porch. And I'm like, okay, you know, and I'm so stoked. And so like, as soon as I get home, it's better than any Christmas morning I ever had as a kid. It's like, you open the box, you know, and you pull that thing out, it's in the plastic bag. You know, you get to like look at the riser and the limbs and the cams and go over that thing. I feel like you never really get that because you're always in it all the time.
Kind of. You know, that's mine right there.
Yeah.
And that's different than my test bow. You know, my test bow is beat to crap. And so I get the new feeling. But the problem is we're always stressed. Like I get that a week before I leave, you know.
So yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm slamming it together and I'm trying to get sight tape and everything's still settling and it's barely tuned and you're questioning everything. And, but that's part of proving ground too. It's like that rapid build and like high stress is unfortunately really good testing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about the Lift X. Tell us about the new bows. I mean, I understand you've got, four different bows this year?
Yeah. Four hunting bows.
Mm-hmm. And then,
yeah, I think the first thing you're going to notice is it's called a lift still, Lift X. Mm-hmm. So it's building upon what we believe is the pinnacle of archery. Last year was the fastest, lightest, most stable, forgiving platform ever built. So we're super pumped about that direction. And our goal this year was, can we make it better in certain features? So number one, there's no hiding around it. We had a limb issue with the lift last year, and it was like a mad dash here with Matt involved, everybody in the company to figure out what was going on, and making sure it never happens again. And so we implemented a change. We sent a letter out to our retailers, like August, that completely changed the way we build limbs. And so, you know, the lift is now warrantied for its lifetime to secondhand owners with this new limb. And we're branding it now as Arc 7. So the Lift X comes with Arc 7 limbs. It's basically armor coating. It's the toughest limb that we've ever built on this platform without sacrificing the performance and everything that we had. And it's one of those things where, you know, early testing showed great stuff on the lift. We had a process change mid-year that was not communicated well that completely changed that. And so we, like I said, it was a scramble. But in that, we learned more about limbs than we've ever learned. And I thought we knew everything about limbs. So the Lift X gets the new Arc 7 limbs, which is also applied to the lift, just wasn't branded. And that was the basis for a brand new system too, because, you know, the lift had, if you could knock anything on the lift, the two things we didn't touch was how it tunes and the grip. We touched every other part on the lift. And so going into 2025 product year, those are the places we wanted to look. We've had designs for tuning systems for a long time, but the top hats were so solid. And, you know, when we think about a technology, the user interface is cool, but if it doesn't last the season, it's not. And like every system that we saw in the field, we saw in our competitors, that we saw in prototypes, never lived up to the durability that we need. You know, it used to be super rare to get a bow to shoot a bullet hole, and then by the end of the season, it keeps that. Well, the top hats did that. The top has always held that tune, and that was really important for us. So limb shift technology started as, you know, an idea of there's tons of ways to tune a bow, but all of them move stuff that we didn't like to move. So some of them move the cups, some of them move the cams left and right. All these are things that we didn't love. It's not the way that we felt it should be done. So limb shift is unique in that the left side limb and the cam are slaved together. They never move. And so they are sandwiched up against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And all limb shift does is move the mod side limb ever so slightly. And we're talking like thousandths of an inch. And that is enough to change the loading to get the perfect tune. And so now your cams get to stay right in the middle, right where they need to be. And you adjust your limb loading slightly to get the perfect tune. And, you know, going back to Arc 7, we needed a really robust limb to do that. And so that was like another iteration. Well, now that we have this, can we do that? And that's, you know, where the testing comes in. But we're super pumped about lift or limb shift technology, because now you can take the two lock screws out, and I call it like tune mode. Now you're in tune mode. You go to the paper tuner, you shoot first arrow, and if you get a left hair, you turn it left. And I do always the top and the bottom now because I can. It's super easy with a 5/32nd wrench. So if I get a left hair, I go quarter, quarter, shoot it again, quarter, quarter. Now you can get it absolutely perfect. So because before you get like a bullet hole, but it doesn't look perfect.
Yep.
You can now get that out. You can like just barely touch it and get boom, perfect bullet hole. And you can even broadhead tune with it. And you can shoot and shoot and shoot without that lock screw in. And so, you know, I even broadhead tuned with them with the screws out this year and just got it perfect. And my rest never moved. Everything was, my cams were dead center, and just tweaked that. And then when you're done, you put that lock screw in, boom, you're done. It never moves. And it holds up to the top hat standard that we have for durability. But now you never have to walk to the press.
Yeah.
And so basically you're getting endless micro tuning, where before top hats could be close, but now you're getting a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
You could always
go ahead.
You could always get it with your rest too. So like you get the top half perfect, then you micro tune your rest, but that always feels weird too, because your rest is dead perfect down the middle. And so now you got the micro adjust at the, and really where it matters, which is that limb loading.
Yeah, it used to be that I would get it close and then I would go to my rest and either move it left or right to try to get the tune. But it's like you're saying, it's always nice that now you can just leave it set at 13/16 and then you just micro tune with your limb shift, and you can turn it, I mean, ever so slightly. And it's marked on each limb, top and bottom on the outside. And you can just make the turn. It'll shift it left or right. It's not actually shifting the cam, right? It's just, it's somehow shifting the load on the limb. Is that the way I understand that?
If you notice, you know, our limbs are always spread a little bit because that applies pressure inward, so there's never slop. Uh-huh. And so we're just taking advantage of that, that we always spread 100,000ths. Now we can spread like 140 down to 40,000ths and just always still spread them, but adjust that spread to get the loads right. And that just changes how that cam comes back, but always leaves like the cam in the same spot. That's the key. Yeah. We're not moving the cam left and right, which changes your center shot. We are just slightly adjusting the loads enough to move it. And what's cool is one turn of that screw is a top hat. So like one hash mark, if you look at the window, every hash mark equals a top hat. And so if you're used to our top hats, like, oh, that's a top hat move. That's just one turn on one of the sides.
Gotcha.
One hash mark.
Gosh, that seems amazing for tuning.
Yeah, super handy for tuning.
Like, really, well, then, it changes the game. Like, the top hats were always, you know, you could press.
I think I talked to Mark before, too. One, I mean, any time that you would change top hats, you're, in essence, you're pressing the bow, you're moving the cams, you're dropping them back, you know, back in the cams, and you have the potential maybe to, you know, nick or ding or drop your cam. And then any time that you're removing the cam or pressing the bow, it feels like you can potentially change the tune of the bow, right? A little bit. So it felt like I was like chasing my tail sometimes. Like it was just a little bit, and not bad, but like a little bit more finicky. Whereas I feel like this at home, you know, I have a press, but I feel like you could tune your left and right, no issues whatsoever without a press, which is pretty handy. Yeah.
Well, like we talked about, when you do have your bow rolling and you do have to throw it in the press, it's not a great
feeling. It's not a good feeling.
Like you kind of want to make just that one little final move, but everything else is great. It's am I really putting this in the press right now?
Yeah,
like you don't want to do it because you know it's inevitably gonna, I mean, it's just some pressure on the bow that you don't ever want it to have once you have it in a certain spot.
Yeah. This is one of those. So I did a review internally, and it's like, if you look at the platform from the lift last year to the lift X this year, I mean, as far as axle to axle, foot per second, weight, If you look at them, it's like pretty apples to apples comparison. But like, I think a lot of people look at the bow and it comes out and they'll say, "Yeah, it looks the same, does the same thing." But I think this little limb shift is a major advantage, and I think people would underestimate how handy it really is.
To be honest, I was skeptical too, because like, we have a press right next to our paper tuner, so it was never, top heads were never a big deal to me. Mm-hmm. But you can throw a wrench in your pocket now and just do it right. It's like, and I can't overstate the fact that like, you would always get a good bullet hole.
Yep.
But it wasn't perfect. And like, people like to see that. It's a confidence builder, especially for myself. So it's like, I can just barely ever so slightly tweak that and just clean it up. And it's like, mm-hmm. It makes you feel so good, especially when you're like, you know, we shoot all our arrows too. We knock two in our arrows and stuff. It's like, if you get one perfect and one slightly off, it's like just a confidence booster that stuff's not settling, stuff's not moving. It's just like that arrow needs knock tune. And it's just another confidence builder that you're using the bow that was the variable is now the standard. And you can look at other things.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Switch Weight X cams. So you guys came out with this cam last year, and it was like the first cam that you'd changed in a few years. Prior to that, we just had the Switch Weight cam, right? And you moved the way that axle mounts to the top of the limb. To me, the cam feels like much harder in the back wall. Does it feel different to you in the back wall? Does it feel more firm?
The back wall is probably pretty similar, but the difference is the how it drops into the back wall.
Phil,
are you shooting 80% or 85?
So I shoot 80s.
Yeah, I do too. And so, you know, a lot of time is spent on the balance between storing energy and then not dumping. You know, we've all shot the bows that just like, boom, collapse into the bottom. And mm-hmm. People say that it feels locked in, but it's really, I mean, one, it's dangerous, and two, it's not smooth. You know, we put a lot of emphasis on, if you're shooting the right weight, can you pull it all the way back and never stop? And, you know, all our bodies, we learn our draw cycle, but you'll never learn one that just falls off a cliff. And so a lot of time spent on the fall slope is what we call it. So how it holds the weight and then that final drop, because you can get one that feels amazing, but you're losing a ton of speed. It would come down, and we had a target bow one time, we called the Valley Mon. Mm-hmm. That would come down really easy and then hit the back wall. The problem with that, though, is that you could come off the back wall and not know. And so there's a real balance here on that back end feel. In the 80s, especially because we're not having to dump all the way to 85, could have a more aggressive feel,
mm-hmm.
but not change the fact that it's not going to dump. If you were taking that same slope all the way to 85, it would dump. And so like, a lot of time is spent on that. And that's honestly one of the reasons why we do individual mods. You know, a lot of people have mods that you can adjust the let off on, but that changes so much that we're not willing to give up in the back end, because every mod is scrutinized to just be absolutely perfect. And there's a huge difference when you are dropping off that far to your draw line, that we want to make sure that's absolutely perfect.
I want to understand your draw mods. So you've got these switch weight mods that you can basically switch your poundage without having to make any adjustments to your limbs, right? So you don't have to turn the limb bolt out. So a set of limbs, for example, if I got a bow, I order a bow and it's a 70-pound bow, right? And it has 70-pound mods in it. How does that work? How do you take a 70-pound bow with 70-pound limbs to 75 or 80 pounds with a mod? How does that work? Can you explain that to me in layman's terms?
You stretch your limb more is really the answer. And so that's where our limbs are so highly loaded right now that, you know, some of the limbs are, I'm trying to figure out a way I can say this without saying too much, but the limbs themselves are made out of a proprietary material, and traditionally, the harder you stress them, the better the bow is. And the trick is, can you stress them more without giving up durability? And that's where the tricks come in. You know, we spend a ton of time on the durability. That's why last year that limb issue was just kind of blindsided, because we've done so much testing on the limbs because we know how hard we're pushing them. So the easy answer is if you take a 55-pound mod and an 80-pound mod and line up the screw holes, you'll see why we get more force.
Gotcha.
You can see what we're doing there. But the key is you can't just do that with any bow. You need a limb that can withstand super high loading and be able to do all the way from 80 pounds to 55 pounds with one limb.
So kind of along with that, this is just another curious question. This is kind of fun because I'm just getting a chance to like ask you some nerdy questions that I've had. Can you use your limb bolts to, you know, back out poundage, right? And then use that in conjunction with a mod to get some sort of custom in between poundage if you wanted to? I mean, I know that you guys have like a low draw or a short draw bow this year with lower poundage mods. Is there all kinds of adjustability that you can use? So like, let's say that I back my limbs out and I've got it at 65 pounds and then, you know, I put a 75 pound mod in it. Is that going to give me some weird results or feel? And
yeah, you just lose a ton of energy. And so the reason we want to do switch weight is as you start to back out your limbs, you're changing how much that limb is preloaded, mm-hmm. and you're changing how it affects where it hits the cam. And so what you're essentially doing is if you take a 65-pound mod or you turn your limb bolts out to 65 pounds with a 70-pounder and then put 75s, you're going to get a really bad 70 bow. You're going to get really slow. You're going to lose 10 to 20 feet per second because it's going to feel bad because as you tip your – I don't know if I can draw – now we're getting really deep in the weeds here. So if this is like your perfect 70 curve, this is your poundage and your draw length. Mm-hmm. If you would take that bow and back it out to 60 pounds, it would look like this.
Gotcha.
So I hit 60, but I lost this triangle of energy. Mm. I can draw a mod that comes up perfect to 60 all the way over, hold your weight, and then comes back down.
Gotcha.
And you'll get 7 to 10 feet per second by doing that.
Huh.
And this doesn't feel good because people say, well, it has a hump in the back. Well, that would feel like a hump in the back because you wouldn't hit 60 till you're like right here. It would be like 50 all the way back to 60. And then,
gotcha.
And it's way nicer to peak fast and then gradual down.
Hmm. So ideally, a bow is most efficient with the limb bolts buried, right?
It's not more efficient. So people say that wrong. It's just you're storing more energy. The bow will stay efficient.
Gotcha.
Meaning like the stored energy versus the speed you get out. But if you store less energy, which is what you're doing when you do that,
mm-hmm.
You're going to be way slower.
Gotcha. How long do you think we see no more limb cups? We just see one contiguous piece. just wondering. let's talk grips. So you guys have a new grip, the Bond grip. I thought the name was clever. Is that like James Bond, or where'd you guys come up with Bond?
James Bond. Yeah. No, I stay out of the naming conversations. I'm not good at naming. Make this stuff. So the Bond grip is a series. We're really hitting that home. So if we've learned one thing about grips, we can't please everybody with one grip.
And yeah.
I think the industry knows that. Everyone's so individual in their setup. So we have grip options in the Bond series, and they're made to click on and off. So our hope is that people will try them out. So we're launching this with the Bond, what we call the Engage shape. It's got a brand new, and this is shared across the line, brand new overmolded rubber back. It's got a tapered texture, so more texture on the bottom than up here because mm-hmm. you don't want texture in the throat. You want that to slip into zero, but when it's wet, you need palm texture. So super cool looking tapered texture with overmolding right where you need it, and then a feature to snap them on and off without glue. And so this is the Engage. Mm-hmm. We also have the Contour and the tapered grip. That's some of those. These are test samples, but here's a tapered grip. This one is made to be flat in the back, square, with a hard edge. This is something a lot of target archers like. It's also 17 degrees instead of 14. And then we also have the contour that people that remember are like wooden grips and stuff.
Yep.
This would be kind of homage of that. This is the one everyone picks up and is like, oh, that's nice. it's just made to fit your hand.
The
standard engage, which is really narrow, slightly rounded, but still flat on the back. Has a new feel than our old engage because of the overmold. And this is the one I'm shooting. But the key is that you can put it on and it snaps in like that without any glue. And so what we're hopeful is people would try them in the shop, find the one that works, and then maybe change it or keep it because they're going to come color matched with four different colors options. We got the white, and then we got gray to match our new shale color. And then we got a green. Here's green. And then tan to match the earth.
Gotcha. Yeah, grips are tough. Nobody has the same grip that everybody likes. Everybody likes a different grip, different angle, different shape, different size.
Yeah. I didn't touch on the last one, but we have sight plates, which we've had for a while. But this year in the bond, we are adding the addition of two different grits of texture for the back. So one, we got like a skateboard type tape. Mm-hmm. And then this one's really cool. It's like a polypropylene plastic that has texture on it. And it feels slick, but when it's wet, it has a lot of stick and tack. So it's kind of the perfect blend of not, if you don't like too much grip back there, this might be the one you like. So super excited about that too.
Gotcha. So you have two bows. You have the Lift X, right? And you have the two different lengths, the 29.5 and the 33.
Yeah.
And then what are the other two bows that you got in the hunting lineup?
One, hopefully something for a 32 and a quarter draw length guy like me.
It's the only reason we had Brady on the podcast today is because he wanted to ask about this bow. This one he's been waiting for a while.
I finally want to upgrade.
This is our internal Caleb bow because Caleb's long too, Brady. But we've been on, so we have the XD and then we have the rocket ship, the RS. But the XD was built off of the 33 platform. It's made to go to 33.5 inch draw down to 32. So only pretty tight window, but the 33 itself picks up at 31.5. So between the XD and the 33, should be able to fit everybody in that bow. And specifically the XD's got a larger cam for those long draw guys. And the only thing you're giving up is 5 pounds. So on the XD, an 80 pounder is going to make 75. A 75-pounder will make 70, but what you get out of it is that extra long length and all the flagship technologies. You know, we've had long draws before, but they weren't maybe had all the new technology accessories, things like that. So this is built in specifically in the Lift line to share all that stuff, which we're super excited about. And then the RS is really short. We have a bunch of nicknames internally for it, but it's 27 3/4, and it's 5.5 inch brace, and it is bar none the fastest bow we've built ever. It's 353 on the theoretical IBO, and it goes all the way to 29 inches, so it could be, you know, short draw all the way down to 41 pounds. We have two different limb options and down to 23 inches of draw, so truly fitting everybody with super high performance. It's one of the coolest looking ones right now because what our favorite thing is that our cams almost hit the riser. That's how tight and compact
this thing is.
When you pull it back, the cams are like an eighth of an inch from hitting the riser as they come around. So
Lorenzo, that might be kind of fun one to play with. 27 and would you say 27.5 inch?
27 3/4.
27 and 3/4, 80 pounds. 20.
That would be a lot of fun.
But Lorenzo, our draw length's a little too long because I think it only goes to 29, right?
Yeah.
Dang.
I can make it work.
Faster though, even if you shot a shorter draw length.
Yeah, it might be actually.
That'd be. Things smoker.
That'd be.
It'd still be fun to mess with.
It would be way fun to play with.
Yeah.
What'd you say IBL on that? 353.
Yeah.
That's what, cooking.
What's I was gonna tell Brady. What's IBO on the XD? At what is it? At what draw length? The 33.
So yeah, we don't have it at 30 inches. So yeah, say 363 at 33.5. Which
yes,
if I can, it's crazy fast because the Atlas, if you remember, went 350 at 34, and this one's going 363 at 33.5. So it is. Yeah. Way fast. It's like 20 feet per second faster.
Yeah. The Atlas is the bow I've still been shooting, so that's why I'm kind of really excited about this one to finally upgrade.
Yeah.
Get some new tech.
Mm-hmm.
And, definitely.
Yes.
What do you hunt with? What weight do you draw? I'm curious.
I shoot 70.
70 flat?
Yeah. I shoot, I obviously can shoot whatever I want here. And our test bows are 70 pounds, 30 inches, and we got to shoot a lot of 80 pounders too.
Mm-hmm.
But I really, for me personally, in a hunting situation, I want a bow that obviously has enough energy for one, but two, I need to be able to pull it without doing anything. I want to be able to put my arm straight out and slow draw mm-hmm. perfectly back. And so 70, I can do that without even thinking. I shot a deer this year in a saddle off side on my weak side. So I was short drawn and I was still able to get it back. It's like those situations matter a lot for me.
Yeah,
I used to shoot a 75 pound bow, and in November when you're bundled up, I one time had a buck in front of me at 24 yards, and I was pulling back, and I hit my tether on my
harness,
and that was enough to stop me. And I just that is the worst feeling in the world to not get back on something. So I shoot 70, 28, and then I shoot a pretty light arrow. I always want to hit above 300. This year I'm hitting 310. For feet per second, and I go way back to when I was growing up. I know the arc of my arrow, and I've shot an arrow that fast for a while now that I just need to hit that speed. I know that if a deer's at 57, I can shoot it for 55 and get it. You know, I understand that in the heat of the moment, if I can just split a 50 and a 60 and let it go, mm-hmm. I'm fast enough to handle all that. So super mm-hmm. important for me.
So as I was driving down here, did you have some questions? Mm. As I was driving down here today, I had a guy DM me, and he was like, "Hey, I have an arrow question," and he basically lays it out. He's a 529 grain arrow with 18% FOC, and he goes through the whole thing. You know, what do you shoot? What do you recommend? And I think I've talked to you. I remember before, but you shoot a pretty light arrow. I remember at one point we talked and I was saying like, yeah, I'm kind of a 300 spine, maybe going to a 250. And you were like, yeah, I'm like 350 spine, if I remember correctly. But talk to me about arrow setups and like, what are you looking for?
Yeah, I'm looking for toughness for number one. So I go as light as the toughness can allow. And so I want an arrow that can withstand anything. And I think I found the perfect insert setup and the best shaft, in my opinion, right now is something with a weave on top. So I shoot a RIP TKO, which is a 204 or 5mm. The key for me on that shaft is a super straight shaft for one and consistent. And then secondly, it's got a wrap on, it's got a weave. And what's important about that is I can bounce a RIP TKO off of rocks. I can bounce it off of anything and I can damage that top layer of carbon without the arrow blowing up. If you have a standard arrow wrap with unidirectional fibers, you just nick that and put that on the compression side when it'll just snap right in half. And so a tough shaft's important to me, and then components. So, you know, 166, I've really always steered away from because the components were so terrible. And if you know anything about like aerodynamics, cross-sectional areas matter so much. And no matter what 166 you're shooting, you're always expanding to a 300 front, mm-hmm. so like your field point, everything. So that is what the aerodynamics are hitting. Now there's some skin drag, but not a lot. You know, the boundary layer of aerodynamics is such that right at the shaft of any projectile, the air is barely moving. There's like this cone of air, and that's why tall vanes will steer something better than small vanes. And we've done tons of tests where, like little AAE PMC 16 vanes you can six fletch those. That has twice the fletching area as three fletch AAE max delves, but will not steer a broadhead to save its life because they're not tall enough. You've got to get into that half inch range. You've got to get out of that boundary layer to steer anything. And so I always overbuild my fletchings and underbuild the weight. Let's see. So I love the AAE Max Stealth. It's heavy, but it is just a killer vane. It can steer anything. I tested, you know, the broadheads I test these vanes with is a crooked Thunderhead from back in the day. I got like three crooked Thunderheads, and this thing will steer them.
Like good name for a van. Important.
Yeah.
Crooked Thunderhead.
Because, you know, you guys know, when you hunt, your bow takes a beating, and I want a vane that will, no matter what, even if my bow's not tuned, will correct it. Because if I want to be able to throw my bow off a mountain, pick it up, pick like a shrub, and try to get my sight back and not care that it's tuned, because this vane I know will take care of it. When you're pushing the limits on a vane, you put a glove on, you put your big heavy coat on, you do anything different, you are asking for trouble because it won't recover as fast. So tall is important, and this is the tallest vane that I can get that's still quiet. A blazer vane's super loud. I would love to shoot them, but they're just too loud. But they get up into the boundary layer above that half inch. So you're
more interested in the height of the vane than the number of vanes, right? So like I see you've got three on there.
Yep.
What would you? So there's a lot, myself included, I've shot, you know, boning heat vanes, right, which is a more low profile, and I've shot them in a four fletch. Would you were saying the height is more important than what I might think it is then. So maybe three fletch.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, on a heat. So back a few years ago, someone asked me, I would say four fletch heats or three fletch stealths. The reason I don't four fletch a stealth is because it doesn't do anything more. That crooked Thunderhead test is what I'm talking about.
Like, yeah.
I don't get anything more other than a parachute.
Yep.
But on a four fletch heat, they're so stiff. That they stay up into the boundary layer. That's the other problem. You shoot a small vane that's flimsy, like a Vane Tech or even those PM16s, they fold down, and so you're not getting up into there. So those heats are stiff enough to stay up in. And I would floor fletch those just because the worst thing that can happen is you go sideways. That's where floor fletch is going to help. You're going to get more surface area right here. But when we're talking about like steering, when you put a broadhead on the front, you're screwing fletchings on the front of your vanes. And so you don't want this to steer you away. That's what we're trying to save with the high vanes. Now, a wind factor, when it blows like this and goes, you know, sideways, that's where your side profile, that's where four fletch is going to matter. But if you got a huge broadhead up here trying to steer your front, you need as much drag as possible. That's why getting high is important, or stiff, like the heat. Yeah.
Gotcha. What do you aim for as far as like FOC? Do you have an opinion on it?
No, I don't measure it.
Where do you think it lands? Like 10%?
I'm probably under that. So I got a 16 grain hit insert, and then I love these Iron Will titanium collars. I shoot that on the front.
Yeah.
I don't glue them on. This thing has been so tough. I know Bill pretty well. I texted him last year because I misset my sight. I skipped it off the rocks. I went through a steel tubular one-inch thing and then busted a piece of concrete with this arrow. And
gosh,
it was totally fine. I could keep shooting it. So that's what I'm talking about, like toughness and stuff. I want stuff like that could go wrong to be overbuilt for, and I want to be as light as possible to do that. So,
and you said you're shooting 310 feet per second?
Yeah.
And that's your hunting rig, hunting setup.
Yep. I'm shooting. This is 395, all said and done.
395?
395,
yeah.
How do you get an arrow that light?
That is light. Wow, that's super light.
How long are your arrows?
What's that?
How long are your arrows?
I cut them carbon at 26 and 5/8, so like right to the rest. I'm 28 inch draw.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are short. Tell me about your guys' strings, because I've had a lot of feedback in the last couple of years. You guys' match grade strings have been much better than the previous versions of the Zebra strings. Anything different that you guys did with those? And I guess one of the questions I had is, are you building those out of the same materials as that you were previously, or is it the same, a different build process, or different materials, or both?
It's kind of both. Same base materials, but different process, post-process.
Gotcha.
And so it's a little bit, we can't just grab a spool that used to make Zebra and make match. We have to get the match specific, but it's the same fibers. Just we changed some of the coating specs. But the key is that we built custom-made string building machines. And so before anything you can buy online, even custom-made, it's hard to get the loading that you would need to settle a string while you build it. And so that was the key to the match, is that we have now 20-plus custom machines that are fully programmed to build these perfect every time. And the key is switch weight, honestly, because when we used to have bows with limb weights, if you build a 70-pound bow, you might have to put, you know, 5 twists in it. But if you're building that same bow but in 50 pounds, it might only take 2 twists to build that to that right axle to axle, because it's not stretching it.
Mm-hmm.
With switch weight, our limb loading is always the same. So we can make these strings perfect, so you put 0 twist in. They literally come out of strings on a hook. You take them off, you put them on, no twists at all, and it's perfect every time. And that's another key to match, is that they're coming off the machine perfect for the length. Because when you talk about peep rotation and serving separation, mm-hmm. the majority of that comes from twisting and untwisting your string when you're trying to get your axle to axle. And so if you can build it under load, under a proprietary number and process time-wise, and then serve over that and then take it off and put it on a hook, and then take that off and put it on a bow and never touch it, your peep's never rotating. Your serving's never coming undone. And so we're trying to eliminate those variables.
Mm-hmm.
On top of aesthetically, as you add twists and take them out, you get that corkscrew weird effect. And so it's really important for us to get it perfect. And we couldn't have done it without switch weight, honestly. It's the reason why it was possible.
So you guys had to build new string jigs, essentially, to build the string, right? Is that what you're saying?
These were by far probably our most technologically advanced machines we have in the building. You know, our bow presses are all automated too, but these are another level, fully programmed, custom built in-house.
Gotcha. What about you guys? So you guys got a new site, huh? You built with UV?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How you feeling about it? It looks cool. I got one on this bow right here.
Yeah, it was great. It was always a long road. It was a very difficult project to work on, just because of the demanding things that we were asking for. We were asking to take, you know, a site that had just launched and completely change it without losing the heart of it. And it was important to pick initially. We knew what we were doing was difficult. We had to pick one company to work with. We're friends with a lot of companies in the industry. And we were very open with people that, hey, we're trying this thing. We talked to many companies about it. We told them what we're trying to do. And we told them that we're going to pick a winner and there's going to be some losers. And if you weren't okay with that, tell me right now, because this is the road we're going on. And everyone was super gracious. We were able to work with a few companies and early on and just figure out, all right, who's going to be the best for Matthews at this time. And UltraView came out on top in that thing. And really, when you come down to boil down, we're at the finish line, looking backwards, what was it that UltraView had? Truly, it's ergonomics. They had the best ergonomics in the site ever made. And it's so evident now when you look at the site that every other site in the industry has some kind of knuckle buster on their dial.
Yeah.
You're always going to run into something when you're trying to dial a site, except for UltraView. And on top of that, their lock is in the perfect position for your finger and your thumb. Mm-hmm. It's right where you need it. So you unlock it and dial the same motion and close it with your thumb. And so ergonomics being top tier, they had that figured out. Now the challenge was, can we build it so compact that it meets our demands. You know, you see all of our accessories that are Matthews Genuine. Our bridge lock stabilizers are as minimal as possible. The bridge lock itself is right in the middle. Our quivers are as tight as possible. Our rest is integrated. So this sight needed to be like that. No jogs, no extra pieces, as minimal as physically possible. And that is way easier said than done. There is so much that went into the design of that. And our team and their team worked countless hours together on this thing, and fights back and forth. I think we're all patched up from that now, but it was dropped. It was as hard as we could go, fighting little fights. And there's 1,000 decisions that went into that thing, and it's perfect now. We are so excited about it. And that feeling, Brady, right there that you just did, that's what it's about. Like, that is so quality feeling, so precise and so ergonomic. And now it fits perfectly in a Matthews, straight out of the riser, as compact as possible.
So it's a good year for accessories. I don't know if you had a chance to probably see what else is ever, you know, I saw that Excel just launched their driver site, and then Dialed has got a new proof site. And then of course your guys' new site that you did in conjunction with UV, but I don't remember. It's been a long time since I remember like a run of sights or a run of accessories in archery that felt like people are really pushing the envelope. And like, there's some really solid options, I feel like, on the market this year. So,
yeah, it's actually, you know, we don't have a grand scheme, but you know, when we came out with BridgeLock, we made it fit existing sights, mm-hmm. but our goal was that sights would just become made for BridgeLock. And that was the goal. We're seeing that across the industry now, that this is the new way to run a sight. It's better in so many ways, mm-hmm. vibration, durability, compactness. And I love to see it. I love to see that the industry was moving to thicker and thicker risers, get more left windage, and now we're moving the right way back to compact and in line. So I love to see it. I love to see the industry changing, and I think it's for the better.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool. It's cool to see new accessories coming in. I was pretty stoked with the site when I saw it. I mean, I'd been asking for 5 pens from UV. And also I like a horizontal pen, and also just bigger pens, cause my old eyes can't see those 15s or 10s anymore. You know, I need a 19 pen. So, I was stoked to actually pull it out of the box and see it all put together. And like you said, I think a lot of the sites that are out this year, I think everybody kind of took feedback and they developed something that improved upon their last iteration by a lot. So it's a cool year for archery, I feel like. I was stoked to see your new site. How much attention do you pay to like what the other companies are doing? Do you guys have a bunch of everybody else's bows kicking around the office there, tinkering with them?
We do. You know, we get them for different reasons, but you know, the things that I care about is I want to see where everyone is on efficiency. That's the metric we use. And I can't stress enough that it is the hardest metric to hit and to beat. And so we always want to see where people are in the industry. We want to see if they're catching up, because from my perspective, that's the area that we excel at. And I want to make sure that we're staying on top of that. And we are. And so it does another thing too. We get to see obviously where they're going, where they're thinking, but also just validate for us that we need to continue to beat ourselves. We do not look at a competitor's bow and say we need to beat that. We are trying to beat last year's Matthews. That is the best bow in our opinion, and we are trying to beat that one. But we definitely keep tabs. We have everything. We want to see what people come up with. And you know, honestly, for a healthy industry, we want our competitors pushing the limits. We want to be driven to go harder. It's that fuel that makes sure that we're hitting it hard every day we come in the office.
Yeah. I figured it'd be just a fun photo op opportunity. You know, I could catch maybe Derek or Caleb, somebody shooting a PSE, and just snap a photo or something. Use it to blackmail them a little bit. Say, look what I got. That'd be funny.
I mean, you know how much black magic is in archery, especially from like a target side. There'll be people who are like, this bow was the best that there ever was for forgiveness or something.
For sure.
We got to get it. We got to shoot. We got to see it. Is there valid validity to that? Or is it fond memories, because that's another thing we learned in archery, is that you always think of your past bows fondly. You don't remember all the headaches. Yeah. And that's funny, because like there's always a honeymoon period with a bow. It's always amazing. And then reality hits and you think back to a fond memory of an old bow. And that's where the funny archery stuff happens.
That's what it is funny, because everybody you talk to that gets a new bow, there's a honeymoon phase with it. And it's, they pull it out of the box, they set it up, it tunes good, they take it to the range, it's the best bow they've ever shot. And I'm guilty of it. It feels like I've a brand new bow. It feels like you never shoot better. For a week, 2 weeks, you're just like, man, this thing is hammering. And then for whatever reason, it's like reality sets in. And I realize that the bow shoots fine, but it's mostly just me behind it, you know, and I'm fallible and human, and I don't shoot nearly as good as I think I can. But there is something funny about a honeymoon, and it just goes to show you how much archery is just between your ears, you know.
It's just, yeah, and you know, that's honestly one of the hardest parts of our job, is like filtering feedback like that. Like, what is actually honeymoon period? What is a valid concern? What was it about that bow that they're remembering fondly, but maybe not exactly remembering correctly?
Yeah,
it's that art of like, okay, they're saying this, but I think they actually mean this, or they're saying this, but can we prove that it's actually doing that? Because there's truth in a lot of it, and there's memories and other stuff. So it's that, you know, empirical data and our own experiences too that matter a lot. It means a lot that we have a lot of true archers in the building, and that carries a lot of weight. That's a lot of brain power. That's a lot of testing. That is very valuable.
So yeah,
take that seriously, but also with a grain of salt sometimes.
What do you think what factor is to be the most accurate with a bow and arrow? Is it draw length? Is it, I mean, I've always said draw length. I felt like if I don't get my draw length nailed, like I just can't shoot a bow as well as I could otherwise. And I had a really funny, I had a bow that was an eighth of an inch difference, which doesn't sound like that much, you know, but I made the change and went back to shooting the bow. And ever since, it just felt entirely way better. It was an eighth of an inch, which doesn't seem like that much, but I was curious as to you, how much does draw length matter?
It depends on who you talk to. So as a rule of thumb, a longer draw length is going to have a slower pin flow.
Yeah.
And the shorter draw length is going to have a faster pin flow.
Right.
And it depends on who you talk to, but like a Chris Perkins, for example, he's going to want a longer draw length. He really likes a slow pin flow, and that guy can hold steady. I mean, he can just hold a pin in the middle. When you talk to like a Bodie Turner, he shoots slightly short on his draw length and light stabilizers because he likes a fast, jittery float. Because in his opinion, he wants to always be floating back to the middle. And if you're slow, you have time to shoot out of it. He wants to get right back in the middle. And so I think it's a lot of style. I think it's personality too. You know, I love shooting Vegas, but I absolutely hate it. I'm not built for Vegas, but if I want to learn my shot, I shoot Vegas rounds. But I love 3D because I have something in me where I don't want to drop. I want to feel like I can earn. I want to shoot a 12. I want to shoot bonus rings. And it takes a different type of personality to shoot paper every time. And so I think the number one, to answer your original question, the number one factor for accuracy is trusting yourself and your shot, and then not giving, this is controversial, but do not give in to the target panic mantra. I feel, and I've felt this a long time, that people talk about target panic like a disease they caught and they can't get rid of. And it's a problem, because once you have it in your mind that I have this thing, all your decisions after that are based on the fact that you have this thing. So you go blank bail, you go change release, you go do this stuff. In reality, what it is a natural phenomenon that you do not want to cover up the thing that you're aiming at. That's what target panic is. Your brain doesn't want to do that. It wants to look at that thing. And being able to be mentally tough enough to just figure that out. And there might be tricks. Like I'll shoot a hinge when I'm getting punchy, when I'm getting target panicked, so to speak. But that is a symptom and not the disease that you have. That's just a symptom of between your ears and not staying mentally strong enough to just cover up that thing and being okay with that thing covered. And I think that is key, especially for new people. Like be consistent in your anchor point, and then just be comfortable with covering stuff up with your pen and fire shot.
Yeah. Interesting. I know that for me, that I think draw length, I brought it to draw length because I'm probably more of a Chris Perkins. I like a long, slow, you know what I mean? And to me, it's probably due to my personality. I get a little bit anxious. So if I've got herky jerky movement and it feels like I'm being pulled in, like I'm almost a little bit collapsing, it feels like I just can't aim as well and I can't get that arrow to, you know, to go when I needed to. So that's probably why lengthening my draw length by a little bit just felt so much better. It just, I felt way more relaxed, felt like I could pull harder into the wall and let it go.
You know, that brings up a great point that in your practice, like I said, I like shooting Vegas to learn my shot. Same thing like with you, if you want to learn your float and all that stuff. And then there's times to practice differently. Like if you look at Randy Ulmer, he's like a hero of mine, but he shoots with a hinge 90% of the time and with a trigger for 10%, and he hunts with a trigger. And I just absolutely love that because he learns his shot, he's disciplined in his training, but he also, when he knows when he has to get something killed, he gets it killed with a trigger. And I think it takes that 90% of training so that you can do that 10% of just getting it done, getting it killed. And so I think there's a really good balance between command shooting and then learning your shot on surprise release. And everyone's different personality wise, but the key is to train that way, to train on purpose. What am I doing today? I'm going to learn my shot today. I'm going to just cover up. I'm going to just pull back and aim and let down again, or I'm going to go kill something. And so I think important to have a plan when you go shoot arrows. Don't just shoot arrows. It's not great for you.
It's hard not to just go shoot arrows because that's fun.
That's why I don't just go shoot arrows.
Do you guys do league night there at the office? Who's the best shot in the office? Who's holding it down? Who's the guy? Is that you?
What? No, not since I had kids, no.
Yeah, gets hard, huh?
It's always fun because, like, certain people can turn it on. There's, like, a handful of guys that are always in the mix, and it's just who's on that night. It's cool to watch.
Yeah.
And they're all different styles, too. That's what we're talking about. It's like that wealth of knowledge is just – you can't buy that. You can't buy that many different philosophies. Like, you look at a Derek Nelson, heck of a shot. Everyone in the world dips low. He dips high. It's like, it's so fascinating to watch him shoot. He just like dips high. No one does that. So it's cool. It's cool to watch, but there's a lot of good shots in the office.
Yeah. Do you guys have big buck contests there?
We have parking lot parties. You have to bring your buck by. And everyone knows who shot the biggest one. You don't have to say anything about it.
Who's got the biggest buck? How'd you do? Did you go on this year?
I did, yeah. I went to Colorado elk hunting early season, first week, and did not get it done. We were on bulls every day, but bed bugles and light stuff, hard to get on them. So we were in the mix, but didn't get it done. Then I came home, killed a really big white tail. On the 7th of October. So since then, I've been doing nothing.
Really big. How big is really big?
How big a whitetail are we talking, Mark?
he's my biggest deer. He's an 8-point. So he scored a 153-inch 8-point. Just a beast of a deer. I learned a lot this year hunting him. I had pictures of him in summer, and he wasn't as – I didn't think he was as big as he was. And then – we had like three cold fronts in a row. We had an early September cold front. It was like on the 20th or something. It was a Sunday. And I hunted that Sunday, didn't see anything. And that Monday I worked late enough where, on my drive home, I drove by the property and I was changing batteries in a camera, came back to my truck and I looked. So I'm like, oh, that's a really big buck. And I pull up and it's that big 8-point. And I was blasting them. I had mag view footage of them. And then I had another big drop time buck. Both of these deer I thought were young deer. And I was looking at them that night. And I was not hunting these deer. I had them on camera, but I didn't think the cameras just didn't do them justice. And I was driving home that night like, what am I doing? Those are both huge, mature deer. And it was that day that actually led me to killing them. So it was the cold front that Sunday, but they were out Monday. And so early October, the 6th, everyone here at work was just jacked out of their minds. It was a Sunday again. Everyone's going hunting, and I didn't go hunting. I waited for the 7th, and I killed them on the 7th. So it was super cool, same pattern.
Is it when you guys get a cold front like that, they're coming through the office, is it pretty well just devoid? Nobody goes in?
Yeah.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it'd be kind of nice to be able to do it that way.
Yeah.
You guys ever get a chance, you should go back and see, because the map, like where the factory is in Matthews, like it's pretty well anywhere around it is like deer habitat, right? What do you say? I mean, you guys could probably be deer hunting within what, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of your job and your house?
I mean, yeah, I killed one right behind work a couple of years ago.
Sounds phenomenal.
It is pretty great. It's pretty cool looking country. And I know that those guys, if you're back there, it doesn't take much of walking around the office there to see that these guys live and breed whitetail.
Yeah.
There's some great whitetail. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can get friends who are excited talking about that.
Or just depressed, because I know it's not in the near future. So more depressed than excited.
You didn't even make it till November then, prime time, right? I mean, if you killed in October.
No. I'm getting twitchy. Yeah, I haven't done anything. I tried to kill a doe with a stick bow a couple times, but I haven't got it done. So.
Do you guys get a second deer tag there in Wisconsin?
In gun season, which is this Saturday, we get another buck tag, but it's a short season. It's tough to kill them with a bow in gun season. You're in blaze orange and deer running everywhere for little lives, so...
Yeah, that's when you get the big push, right? The deer pushes and people out home in the woods.
Yeah, biggest militia in the country.
Well, right on. Anything else? Anything new on the target line?
Yeah, so all the technology that we have on the hunting line is transferred to the titles.
Okay.
So the title 36 and 38, and then... We filled that line out too. So we have a 40-inch with a 7.5-inch brace height. That's going to be our indoor bow.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a short draw 34-inch kind of crossover again with all that technology. So there's limb shift, there's the bond grip system, and then all of our accessories.
What does the draw length go to on the 34? Does it make it to 30, 30 and a half? Or is it shorter than that? I was just
kidding. 4 seconds.
I was just curious, because when you said a crossover. What do you mean by crossover? Do you mean crossover hunting?
30.
Gotcha.
Yeah, 24.5 to 30.
Gotcha.
Crossover just from axle to axle standpoint. So if our lift ends at 33, mm-hmm. this picks up right there. And so a lot of people do like that, you know, longer axle to axle. And that could be a do everything bow for sure.
Yeah. It'd be fun to play with. Your titles, are they a switch weight X cam, or are they just a regular switch weight cam?
They are, we call it a SWT cam, switch weight target. So you can tell they're smaller.
Yeah.
So like a mini version.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got perimeter weighting. That was a big key too. If you notice, our limb angle is really far forward, which is great for like stability and stuff, but it makes the bow feel absolutely terrible. And so we actually tuned the feel of the bow with those cam weights.
Gotcha.
Switch weights shouldn't work on that bow. It just barely works. And that was another head scratcher for us. But we got 70 to 50 pounds with that as well, with their own mods, so SWT mods.
Right. You like your job, Mark? You enjoying it over there?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I've been saying this a lot. I'll say it here. I came to Matthews for my passion, and I stay for the mission. You know, Matt McPherson is, there's no other human on the planet like him. What he does with the profits here are worth staying for. You know, passion for archery can only take you so far. I've been here 13 years, and some of that stuff starts to wear off, but the mission that he has built, what he does, that's why you stay. That's why you have this, the place that we have. And so our mission is clear based on his mission.
That's cool.
Sounds like every day's got to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's cool. Well said.
He's looking forward to it.
That's an amazing, I guess, sentiment for leadership, right? That you know, you believe his mission is so deep and so passionate that it bleeds down through everybody. That's awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
That's cool. All right. Well, we've kept you for a while, so we'll cut you loose. You're on Central Time, right? You're probably missing dinner. Your wife was be like, "Hey, where are you? Okay, thanks, man. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you.